This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue-collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue-collar workers for blue-collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Close your eyes, exhale, feel your body relax, and let go of whatever you're carrying today.
Well, I'm letting go of the worry that I wouldn't get my new contacts in time for this class. I got them delivered free from 1-800-CONTACTS. Oh my gosh, they're so fast.
And breathe.
Oh, sorry. I almost couldn't breathe when I saw the discount they gave me on my first order. Oh, sorry. Namaste.
Visit 1-800-CONTACTS.com today to save on your first order.
1-800-CONTACTS.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by HuntStand. HuntStand is the number one hunting app in the country, and at only $29.99, HuntStand offers a ton of functionality for hunters all over the country. Whether you own your own property or strictly hunt public, you can choose from over a dozen base maps, view property ownership information, 3D mapping, local weather, log your sightings and harvest, as well as use their trail cam management software, and print maps from your hunt areas. Download it today at the Apple App Store or Google Play. HuntStand. Upgrade your arsenal.
Welcome to the Land and Legacy Podcast. We're your hosts, Adam Keith
and Matt Dye.
This is your number one resource for all things land.
If you're interested in conservation, habitat management, hunting strategy, and rural real estate, this is the podcast for you. All right, guys, welcome back to another Land and Legacy podcast. We've got a super exciting show for you this week. This is one of my favorite times of the year, not only because obviously we're hunting and it's, what, the first week of November as this is dropping. So deer chasing and it's all that jazz is great. But what also gets me excited is for the ability to allow other people to come in and on the podcast to discuss recent successes that they've had, whether that be clients, whether that be podcast listeners. This is a time frame where you kind of reap the rewards, or you're able to pick the fruits of your labor. And you know, hunting and that success is obviously a byproduct of, or let's say the repeated success is a byproduct of quality habitat management. And so this week we're going to hear from a gentleman, a client of Land and Legacies, Mr. Patrick Stewart. And he owns some ground in central Kentucky as a non-resident landowner. And we'll get some more of the scoop here of his ownership and what he's been doing and why he ended up contacting Land and Legacy. But I think from the start to finish, you're going to hear a lot of cool points. I think it's going to resonate with a lot of people. Maybe it's property size. Maybe it's, you know, the mental side of executing all this habitat work. Or maybe it's the fact that, you know, he's got just weekends to be able to devote to this. And then, you know, 2 weeks ago, he kills a really nice deer on the farm and his third set in and multiple encounters with other great deer. So all around, there's so much good things to talk about. We're going to try and pack it into this week's episode, 30 or 40 minute discussion, and just kind of give you an understanding of what the last, let's say, 9 months have been like for Patrick and his family as they've been rehabbing this property. So before we jump into the podcast, be sure to check out Vortex Optics. Check them out online. Be sure to go to the apparel link and check out Vortex Apparel. Got lots of new lines, a fall line, lots of cool swag. When you're checking out the optics for hunting season, go over there, use the code LEGACY20 at checkout for all your apparel, and give them a look-see. But let's get Patrick on the phone, because that's going to be a fun discussion. So hang on with us. We'll get Patrick on. All right, Patrick, are you there?
Hey, I'm here.
What's going on, man? Hope you're ready to podcast.
We'll give it a shot here and see how it goes.
That's right. Man, there's so much to discuss here. It's not where do we begin, but I don't want to leave any of the good stuff out, because there's been a lot happening over the last 9-10 months for you. So why don't we start with some general ownership, let's say details, where the farm's located, where you're at in the world, rough property size, but then what the farm or what your involvement in habitat management has been prior to us coming to see the farm. I think that was in early April or real late March. Is that correct?
It was late March.
Late March.
March 27th, I believe.
I know turkeys were gobbling, so it was somewhere in that ballpark.
They were getting with it.
They definitely were. So kind of give us that backstory ahead of consultation.
Sure. So, you know, like probably many of your listeners, just had that desire to own my own piece of ground. And you know, was able to make this happen back in 2017. I was very fortunate. I don't own this farm on my own. I own it with some other family members. We originally purchased 150 acres there in South Central Kentucky. I guess you could call it a working cattle ranch is what it was back in the day. A pretty small operation. Some diversity in what the habitat offered, with a decent mix of open fields, you know, fairly rolling timbered land. Did have some a creek on it that it runs most of the time. Even when there's a drought, if it's not running, it'll still have deep pockets of water that hold water. So I saw it as a lot of opportunity, and I looked at a bunch of properties, and when I finally found this one, you know, I saw the potential in it, and fortunate enough to purchase the original 150 acres. And then in 2019, additional 80 acres that joined us came up for sale, and this was a little bit different property. It was probably 90% clear cut back in 2013, so mm-hmm. Different opportunity there, but you know, by being able to purchase the additional land, we kind of secured, you know, some boundaries, and it just didn't fit really well. So very blessed. 230 acres is what we're at now, and we've been going at it with the habitat stuff.
So ahead of that time, you know, you're acquiring the 230 acres, but you're not, you might be, let's say, new to land ownership, but you understand, I think you've got a landscaping extensive background there. You understand how the natural world works. You are getting into the habitat side of things. I think, man, we first met years ago at NWTF. Is that right? One
yeah,
of the
that's
turkey
correct.
Turkey conventions. I don't know. Was that 3 years ago, maybe?
3 or 4. You guys did an after hours and attended that. And then all of a sudden you said, hey, we're going to do a podcast. Come up and have a seat. I had no idea what we were doing.
Oh, my gosh. That's right. I forgot. This isn't your first time returning guest.
Yeah, I'm surprised you had me back after that.
Of course, man.
No, I've been a follower for sure. And, you know, I listen to a lot of podcasts. I try to take in a lot of information. I try to, you know, discern what's applicable to me and, you know, what there's a lot of stuff I hear that I know that it's not for me, but
sure.
I like what you guys do. I like the foundation that your guys' habitat management sets. And, and I know that's long lasting. It's not a one and done. It's not plant a food plot and then have to do it again next year, even though that's incorporated to the habitat stuff that you guys, you know, encourage folks to do. I followed you guys, and yeah, I think I aggravated you for 2 or 3 years saying how much would it be, you know, we talked and you would answer questions and whatnot, and you know, finally was just pulled the trigger and said let's get it done.
I was breaking you down, man. No, I think you know, it having a consultant, I guess, come out, I want people to think long and hard about it. I want to make sure that it, you know, Adam and I and Frank and Kyle are the right fits for what it is that you're trying to do and accomplish. So, I'm glad that we've had the relationship prior to a consultation. You as a listener and just diving into getting more information regarding habitat management, and then actually moving forward with a consultation, because it kind of gives this a great backstory, I think, to what it is that you're doing, and what it is that you've been able to accomplish. So that kind of, I think, brings us up to speed pretty much until that consultation in late March. And what were you expecting as a consultation, and you went as a walking tour type consultation, so it was not like a full management plan. You knew what you were doing. You wanted some sound advice, if you will. I want to put words in your mouth, but it, from my point of view, it was more or less, I want to make sure that I'm doing things right. What can I tweak? What can I enhance? I know kind of the direction I want to go, but before I go all the way, make sure that this is right. I don't want to make, you know, big mistakes that cost me 5-10 years worth of management time. So what was kind of what you wanted to get out of it? And then did it meet your expectations?
Sure. Yeah, I think you kind of alluded to some of my background. So I do have a degree in natural resource management, and that's my concentration was in forestry resources. So I have at least a basic knowledge of, you know, some of this habitat stuff. Before I ever booked with you guys, I reached out to another client of yours that was in a similar area that you guys had him on the podcast. So I'll throw his name out there. Heath Sutton, you know, he was a great reference, and I asked him about his experience with you guys. And, you know, I simply asked him, I said, hey, would you do it again? He said it was worth every penny. So, you know, that was a good selling point for me. He wasn't trying to sell me something. I just was able to contact him out of the blue. And, you know, he shared some of the information that he gathered, and he even showed me some of the maps that you guys put together. And I realized, even though I was working hard and I felt like I had a plan in my head. I didn't have it on paper. So what I wound up doing for a couple of years was I would do something. It would maybe not give the results I wanted, so I would change it again. And so I was...
Interesting.
But I wasn't doing such big projects that, you know, that they were long-lasting. I really dabbled in the TSI and, you know, the edge feathering. And like I said before, I own this property with other family members. So everything I do, I wanted to make sure that I didn't do something that took value away from their investment just to benefit my deer hunting.
Sure.
And so that was one of the things you and I talked about. And, you know, we, even when we chose locations to do certain management practices, we looked at, you know, what's the value of the timber in here, or can we move it 30, 40 yards one way or another to cut some less desirable species or whatnot. And, So those things were always on my mind when I was trying to look at habitat improvements. You know, you and I had several phone conversations. I was wanting to get started when I finally got you guys booked. It was the end of March, and, you know, that's kind of towards the end of that winter spring habitat season for a lot of us, because it starts getting warm, it starts getting to turkey season. So I was actually, you were working me through some of the bigger projects, and I was working on those and even completed a couple of them before you stepped foot on the property. So you know, that was good for me. I think once you got there, you saw my desire and what I was going to, you know, you weren't going to make a plan and I was going to sit on it and not accomplish it.
That's right. So, yep. There's eagerness.
Oh yeah. Yeah. You know, I've owned it for the property for 5 years, and I, you know, I won't lie, I saw it kind of regress for a couple of years, and those were based on some decisions that I made, trying to make a little money on the farm. I put some of the, what was pasture land, originally kind of a grown up pasture. I went in and I put it in orchard grass, you know, so, and my intention was to grow some quality orchard grass. I'm in a community with a lot of horses, and, you know, for a couple of years we were selling square bales and doing pretty well with it. But reality was I was hurting my hunting opportunities based on where those hay fields were located. So, you know, I wanted somebody on there to say, we can take these out, we can make these improvements, and this is what we can expect going forward.
Right. And I think that you had done a lot of the normal, typical, let's say, recreational landowner type things, but there was definite desire to do more. I think there's a little bit of a hesitancy to go extreme. I want to say, I shouldn't say extreme, but let's just say that 100% level, because for fear of what it was going to look like, as well as, is this juice going to really be worth the squeeze? Like, am I really going to be able to expect what it is these two goons talk about on a podcast? Like, or am I just going to go out there, sweat like crazy, run a chainsaw, and just drop a bunch of trees that seems haphazard? Like, is this really going to have that effect and impact? Am I accurate in that?
Oh, you were. You know, I had some moments of humility when you were walking the property with me, because we would go in an area. I'd done a lot of cedar removal. I still got a lot to do, but I would
have
gone in and cut cedars, you know, and you feel like you've cut the world down.
Yeah.
But you look up and, you know, you're still at 80% canopy, and you go through a growing season and it didn't respond the way I wanted it to. And we went to a couple places, and I remember you're like, all right, what were you trying to do here? And I was like, you know, I knew the answer to the question. I was trying to get sunlight on the ground to get a better response, maybe for bedding and whatnot. Reality was I was doing some pretty dang good TSI, but I was not
right.
I wasn't improving the habitat that much for deer, turkey, and, you know, and other wildlife.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You were thin in the mid-story and felt like, because the visual change had changed quite a bit, that the sunlight would then, let's say, reappear. But after leaf out type situations, it wasn't happening. You weren't yielding that response in the understory like you wanted, desired, had intended to kind of create.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I went back in and reworked several of those areas. And I'll say, you know, even though, you know, some of those walkthroughs were humbling because I didn't get to where I wanted on the front end of those, I also didn't make major mistakes that I couldn't correct.
That's right.
So yep. I think that was, you know, that's an important thing for folks to realize.
Oh, totally.
You know, work your way into it till you're comfortable. And then, you know, you can start to see the response and the real desire of what you're trying to accomplish. And then it really just starts to come together. It was very eye-opening.
Definitely. So let's go to post consult. What have you been working on up until hunting season? What has now kind of taken up your time? Where have you been putting energy into the farm? And were there areas of the farm that you thought were wasted acres, unproductive, that now are fully incorporated into your plan moving forward?
Sure. You know, 2021, like I said, you kind of got me kick-started there even before the consult, but did a lot of edge feathering around my largest field, which we, you know, we made a destination food plot up there. We worked on four different bedding areas or bedding thickets, and, you know, we've got six more to go, but
mm-hmm.
I think we hit the ones that were maybe the most important based on the habitat types and the fact that it was a lot of closed canopy forest. Some of the others we're going to go into are areas that have maybe been thinned more recently, or there's some areas in the clear cut where sunlight's still hitting the ground, but we've got stem densities that, you know, we need to work on and get some of that thinned out.
So basically, you started where it kind of needed the most help, right? The other areas that have been thinned, there was already a response from previous logging. So a higher stem count, young forest, understory kind of developed, and you went to other areas that were like choked out, closed canopy, yeah. Very little regen, very little cover, just really needed a heck of a start.
Yeah, the areas that once we opened the canopy up, they were going to truly respond, and it was obvious. You know, after hunting the farm for 4 years, you learn the way the deer want to move, you know, where the turkeys like to roost, and
right.
And you know, I had that information, which I thought was important to add to the information you provided. So we
complements, you know, it so well. It's very necessary. Yeah.
It was. I had a lot of ideas. I needed another set of eyes and the confidence to move forward on some projects, and
mm-hmm.
and that's where we got. So also in 2021, I was fortunate. I got to work with the Kentucky Division of Forestry, and on my 80-acre piece, they did a 30-acre burn.
Yep.
In there this year, you know, came out. They set everything up. They did the burn. On that, we completed an 8-acre burn, me and my wife and two boys, on another piece of the farm that had some TSI work done a couple of years ago. So
let's talk about that for a second.
Okay.
Because if I remember correctly, there was some hesitancy, too, on you completing fire yourself. And I we do not push people who are uncomfortable to burn. Let's say this, there was knowledge, there was experience in you, I guess, that I could see that you needed more confidence. You had the ability, but you weren't confident in yourself to be able to execute. So I think we talked about a few areas or at least one unit in particular that the boundary road system the fire breaks themselves, it was a very, very safe burn. And with your experience of, well, you weren't there actually when the Kentucky burned, right? The state?
No.
Right. But you executed it yourself.
Yep.
With your family.
Yep.
I love it.
Yeah, it was fun. You know, we had got our fire breaks in, and my hesitancy is not my fear of fire. I'm actually a fireman.
Right.
But my hesitancy is making sure that I have enough people on the ground so that we can do a safe burn.
Certainly.
And you mentioned me being a non-resident landowner, so a lot of times I'm working by myself, or maybe one of my boys are up there, but
mm-hmm.
you know, that we thought with four of us, we could tackle that 8 acres, and we were able to do that. And, you know, we did gain a lot of confidence. We'll do more this year.
Right.
As we look at the burn plan and what needs to happen. So
if memory serves me correct, you guys burned late one afternoon and into the evening too. It was kind of a night burn, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, in Kentucky, I think it's like
after 5 or after 6, something like that.
February 1 through whenever they lift the burn ban, April sometime.
Right.
Yeah, it's after 6 p.m. Central time. So your decent burn window is super short because, you know, you get the sun going down and the humidity pops up. But, you know, that being said, if you're doing that with limited personnel, there is a little safety factor built in. You're mm-hmm. just going to be more frustrated probably that you're not getting it to burn well, as opposed to worrying about it getting out on you.
So what that does is it, I think it helps people almost kind of get into burning because of that humidity factor. And so instead of containing some of those fires, that's not your concern. It's making sure that there's, or encouraging it to be able to burn. So that's kind of a great way to get started burning. But like you said, you've got the experience now with the family, and you're looking into the next couple of years. So essentially, in total, there's 38 acres that were burned this spring on your place.
Yep.
In two different units. Wonderful. Wonderful. What else kind of had you guys occupied?
So a big thing, we decided to take out all the orchard grass pasture,
mm-hmm.
convert probably, I'm guessing, 3/4 of it to old field,
mm-hmm.
and then in that, making one about 3.5 acre destination food plot, and then another smaller food plot off of a lower field there.
Right.
So, you know, the frustration with being a non-resident landowner is timing. You can't have perfect timing. So I did spray it this spring, and, you know, calibration was good. And, you know, I had a pop-up thunderstorm within an hour. So I got a fairly decent kill.
Right.
But not where I want it. So my next trip up here at the 1st of November, you know, it's going to get another dose of glyphosate, and you know, we should be off and running, and then I'll burn all of those fields that we spray in the spring.
Perfect. So you got 4 of the 10 bedding thickets done, some additional edge feathering, burning, any other practices? And I know I actually posted a picture from early September. I think it was maybe from one of your hunts or scouting missions out there. But your food plots, the clover plots, the revival was looking fantastic on the place.
Yeah, I had really good luck. That was a food plot that we planted in fall of 2020. So, you know, it was almost exactly a year old when mm-hmm. when I sent you those pictures. And, man, it's been really good. I will say, you know, I did focus this year on my food plots, making sure I pulled soil samples.
Yeah.
Worked with a local co-op, and, you know, I said, let's get it right. You know, what do I need? Not just my NPK. Let's hit all the micronutrients. Let's do this thing. And it helped. I already had my pH in a good spot. We did a little tweaking mm-hmm. with that, but, you know, I made that extra effort with my soil samples and getting the right nutrients on the ground. And it, I really believe it made a difference. Like even my fall food plots this year, they look good. Part of that's timely rains.
Yeah.
But you know, part of it's getting that soil prepared so that it was optimal growing conditions.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's a, you've been busy, let's say. You've been busy, but that kind of paints the picture to go into the fun stuff, right? Where we're talking about hunting and how that's changed, and it's changed for the better. And I want everyone to, as before we get in there, we met in late March. You're already working, doing some work there. You've been very busy since. You've been intentional with the practices and the time because that there is a plan and a firm direction and where to go and what it is you're trying to create. Then we roll into hunting season, and within all that time frame, yeah, there's a single growing season for plants, for sunlight, everything to kind of respond. And I say that because that's a short window, and it's only going to continue to get better as the years develop, as the plant communities develop more, as then you reset them and put more prescribed fire on the ground, as the old field really begins to develop and take place and significance there, it's going to continue to get better. So keep that in mind as Patrick talks about, and I can say it's the first three sets of the year for you, because it's your only three sets of the year because it was that good. So why don't you wrap us and bring us into kind of the success and kind of compare and contrast between 4 or 5 years prior to this year.
Okay. So, you know, this farm, I knew the potential early on when we bought it in 2017. You know, I wound up getting a picture of a deer that was just over 220 inches, and that deer was killed a few days later, maybe a half mile, three quarters of a mile from my farm. Had no idea that deer was on my farm. But so we had that deer, and then I believe in 2019 we had a 12 point that we believe was, you know, at least a 170. So we were seeing the bigger deer, and we've killed a couple. I think I killed one that was in the 140s there in 2017. A hunting buddy killed one in the 150s in 2019. So we've had success. What I didn't see was maybe the holding power from that I really wanted to establish on the farm. And so I can say, you know, with the work we did this summer and the bedding areas and whatnot, I mean, my cameras just blew up. And, you know, they blew up with bachelor groups. A lot of times I was daylight, you know, as they're going back to bed, you know, 30 minutes after daylight or an hour before dark. So I knew I was holding those deer on my property, which was my goal all along.
And which is provides probably so much confidence, right? That you're like, no, they're on me. They're not on neighbors. I'm watching them go to the bedding area that I cut. Like that's where they're daylighting.
Exactly. And then actually, you know, I said we got in four of the six bedding areas, and really the two bedding areas that we had cameras adjacent to were two that we put in really the closest to my cabin, closest to you know, a main road. Mm-hmm. And when we were looking at the farm, I remember you saying, hey, Dad, we need to do something here and don't sleep on these areas. And I was like, okay, because I knew they had been very unproductive for 4 years.
Right.
So intentionally I put those cameras near those bedding areas. And
you're like, I'm going to prove, you know, Matt wrong. He's going to be a liar. Watch this.
No, I was really hoping to prove you right, because I can tell you my back had done a lot of hurting over the spring and summer with the chainsaw work.
Yeah, no doubt. But
I, you know, I was very excited. Both of those bedding areas had a doe group. One of them had occasional bucks going through. The other one, even the smallest one, it had a bachelor group that they just hung out there. There were four different bucks, and you know, you probably wouldn't go a day or two without seeing them. And And the thing about my farm, you know, we're about 35 out of 230 that's actually open.
Mm-hmm.
We do have pinch points, but this is not, it's not a Midwest farm where you're going to set up on a, you know, a pinch or an open gate and you're going to get every single deer that passes through.
Right, right.
So, I know when I get a decent number on deer, I'm not getting a whole lot more, or I know I'm not capturing every deer in that area. That's not something I worry about, you know, having to know every deer, but I was very pleased with the results. You worked with me on some food plot architecture. We put in 3.5 acres of Stratton. I believe they were Gen 1 beans this mm-hmm. year. And, man, they absolutely hammered them. I mean, they provided food all summer, all the way up to fall food plots, you know, start getting established. But,
right.
I didn't make any bean pods, but I was okay with that. I wasn't planning on leaving it for that.
Sure. Sure.
I fed the deer that I was hoping to feed with that food plot.
Well, and one thing I think that may sound insignificant, but in the grand scheme of things, it's something to point out, is you talked about going into these areas that were close to the cabin, ones that mentally you had kind of put on the back burner and that you hadn't provided much attention to because you just didn't think necessarily that it would happen in that close proximity to the cabin or maybe to neighbors or whatever. You just hadn't experienced a lot of deer activity there in the past. But when you did the work, deer responded. And yes, right. Bachelor groups responded, but also what's significant is doe groups as well had been and then still routinely bed in there daily. And then so at the to bring it, I guess, that point full circle, what's happening right now, bucks are on their feet and they're going to these areas. And so by redistributing the way that doe groups and bucks are utilizing the property, you're then now at this time of the year spreading those bucks across the entire property. So the more that the does are spread out on the property, that means that the bucks are forced to do the same thing. So they're on your property more. They're on your property during daylight hours more, both bucks and does, but they're across all aspects of the property because of the redistribution of this type of preferred cover. And so it makes the property more huntable, but it also makes it, even though you're making deer kind of use the whole property, they're still going to walk where they're going to walk in, you know, this creek crossing, that fence crossing, this bottleneck in between this ridge or that saddle. They're going to continue to do that. They're just going to do it more because they're traveling to these different areas. So it seems like it would make sense to confine everything. But when you have 230 acres, why put it all in 40 acres when you can attract and pull and utilize all the 230? It really increases that holding power and capacity, but it makes the bucks, when they're searching for those does all across the property, expose themselves that many more times to you as a hunter. And that's what's important and increases the opportunities of success.
Yeah, these bedding areas, they offer more stand locations now, obviously.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It makes the property hunt bigger because, you know, I feel like those deer are spending more time on me. And, you know, we're kind of the outlier in this neighborhood. I've got good neighbors. I've got neighbors that will allow deer to walk.
Yeah.
But they're not doing the habitat improvements that we're doing.
Sure.
And I you know, this year when we had the shift in September, deer that I believe were 3.5 and older, I think there was 4 of them. I didn't lose a single deer during the shift. Matter of fact, I picked up a couple.
Wow. That,
you know,
nice.
I think are 3.5. And on 230 acres, that may not happen every year, but we've still got more improvements to do.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you're not even halfway done on implementing the bedding thickets, and look at what they're changing. So
yeah.
That's a wonderful piece to acknowledge. But let's talk about, you know, your first, second, and third sit of the year.
Sure. We I normally try to plant my food plots around September 1st. It's just kind of been a goal. Mm-hmm. And I'm last 2 years, maybe three, dry weather has just, it's made it difficult. So,
yeah.
You know, and we had a dry summer there in South Central Kentucky. So I'm like, I'm going to wait.
Right.
So I chose to wait till the weekend of September 11th and could go up and get a couple of hunts in. And so it's kind of a combined trip, but hunted the evening of September 10th, first mm-hmm. hunt, set over that Stratton perennial plot. And I think I got there. We had a little cool front. I got there probably 2 hours before dark. It wasn't super early. And I had $5 in the plot when I got there.
Hello.
So, I was able – I've done a bunch of screening. I did a bunch of annual screening this year, and I was able to get into the blind. And, you know, there was not a single moment all evening that I didn't have a deer in front of me. And I saw 10 deer. All 10 were bucks.
That'll work.
It was enough. Yeah, it will work. It's an anomaly. I know that. But, you know, you sit there and you smile and you're like, hey, it is what it is. I'm going to enjoy it.
That dog will hunt. Yeah, right on.
we had identified what we thought was a 3.5-year-old 10 point, probably in the mid 130s, maybe pushing 140. That I said, guys, he needs to grow and we're going to give him a pass. And sure enough, first evening, he stepped out at 12 yards from me.
He tested you.
He walked right around the blind, and yeah, just, but you know what? I didn't even pick my bow up. Not that I wasn't excited to see him, but I'm like, I made that decision. I want to give these deer that opportunity to get older.
Yeah.
To see what they can do. You know, I'm doing the work on the farm. Let's give them the opportunity to show their potential.
Ooh, I like that.
Based on the work that I'm doing. So
I like that. I'm exposing the potential of the farm. So I need to allow the deer to do the exact same.
Sure.
I like that.
So that was the first sit. Second sit was September 11th, set on the destination food plot up top. I think we had a southwest wind, which worked well for that. Saw 15 deer that night, 8 bucks. Had a 5.5-year-old 8-point come out that we got a lot of history with. He's never really expressed great antler growth.
Yeah.
He may score 130 inches.
Right.
But I think we've got 3 or 4 years of history. I got a match set of his. We call him 7-Up. Just really cool to see. He walked right out of the old field that management area that we had established up there. And really what I got out of that this year, got a grass that's growing. Foxtail.
Yes. Grass. Yep.
Bunch of foxtail. That was my biggest response. But it grew up fairly tall, and I really believe he was bedding in that foxtail from where he came out of.
Right. And that's not something to expect like right every single year. That's a very early annual that's going to mm-hmm. pop up, and that's going to change and morph into other plant communities as time goes on. But it does grow tall enough that early season like that, sure, it can be utilized as cover. And it sounds like deer are doing that.
They were, you know, I'd been going through the farm and working on food plots and just kind of looking. I mean, I was finding beds all in that area that was converted to. It's really not old field yet. We're in a conversion phase with a lot of foxtail in it. And so just that response, knowing this is just the start, that was pretty cool.
Sure.
So saw those deer. Then this last weekend went back up to the farm. I don't even know what day it was. Last Friday. So it had been the 22nd of October. Was that they really took my 10-year-old. He loves to hunt with his crossbow, trying to get him on a deer. We got in a little bit late Thursday night.
Yep.
And Friday morning, he's like, Dad, I want to sleep in. So, I'm not going to force you. So
sure.
I went to a stand. We had a deer with several years history we called Tidy 10. And he's narrow. I mean, he's just not a wide deer. He, he never really was going to score a lot, but he kept putting on mass, and
that'll work.
You know, he's not going to score a ton, but he stayed on that end of the farm, the 80 acres where the clear cut's at, and the where we did the burn this year. You know, being an October morning, I didn't want to get too aggressive, so I went and sat up on a ridgetop. Really, it's on a food plot. To be honest, I was more there as an observation than anything else, but
sure,
I was also in a safe place for the wind. I was easy access and still with pretty good potential of seeing something.
Yep.
So, you know, around 8:30, I see this deer coming up out of the burn, and got my binoculars up and recognized who it was right away. And he's still probably 80 yards in front of me. And this is a narrow ridgetop food plot. And he just came out and started eating. Knowing the way the deer act up there, I knew he was either going to turn and go back the way he came, or he was probably going to walk the length of that food plot and give me a shot. And
yeah.
And sure enough, you know, after about 20 minutes, he got his belly full. He picked his head up, and he, you know, just came on a string, and I'm ready for him. And, you know, he had been out long enough. My nerves had calmed down, and I'd already done a bunch of ranging. And so I'm following, just kind of waiting for him to stop or maybe turn his head. And he gets almost even with me, and literally he looks directly away from me and takes a step and, you know, quarters away at 17 yards and just stands there like, you know,
do it now.
So, you know, I was very fortunate. I was blessed. I made a good shot on him. I did hear him crash down over the hill, and gave him some time, found my arrow, and you know, had a decent blood trail, went back and got my 10-year-old, and we came back and recovered the deer. So
awesome.
Just a great morning, you know.
And where'd he come out? Didn't you do some edge feathering on that plot as well?
Yeah, the plot kind of runs somewhat east to west.
Yeah.
And on the south side, we had a decent amount of junk timber growing up, and it wasn't necessarily shading the plot too bad, but knowing we were going to do a burn, I went in there and edge feathered that back really hard, probably 20 yards off that field, all the way up to the field edge. And we expanded that field on the north side of it this year. Even did some work on a skitter trail that, you know, it was the easiest route coming out of what I would just call a big bedding area.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I opened that skitter trail up with the chainsaw work, and, you know, he read the script. He did exactly what I was hoping a deer would, not necessarily that deer, but
sure,
that he happened to be the right one at the right time.
Absolutely.
So, you know, that was the same food plot. I saw that deer 3 years ago on another first sit on that food plot. Thought he was a 3.5-year-old at that point. And
that's, you know, cool.
I didn't shoot him then. So it was pretty cool that I've, you know, I had that history with him, mm-hmm. knew exactly who he was. And, you know, now he's at the taxidermist.
I love it. Cool, man. That's a good story and kind of culmination to, or let's say a look into the future of taking deer that are using a farm to some degree, holding them longer, and just like think of all the bucks that are like 2 and 3 years old right now that are utilizing the property. You probably got a ton from the sounds of it, and it's like, what you're seeing now, what you're documenting now, you're creating the habitat that's going to hold them. That clear cut held that deer, right? I mean, he favored mm-hmm. that portion of the property. But you're doing that throughout the entire property, not just, you know, a clear cut that the previous owner had done that now you acquire. This is work mm-hmm. that you're doing. So you're in the making, those 2 and 3 year olds that you've been observing on the cutty links or in the food plots. And that's exactly what you're creating for the future. It's only going to get bigger and better as the resources available to them, are that much more superior. So there's only good to come from what you're doing, the intensity that you're doing it at now. And I'm excited for another return to the podcast and not just one success story here, you know, year after year, and hunts to be able to be shared with your family and your sons that come up, and your wife to get into the work of burning and watching you guys just develop and learn about this place. Cause that's what's the full story. The hunts are cool. The hunts are great. And I love to be able to talk about and have that success shared on the podcast. But being able to do it with family, that's awesome. That's super special.
Appreciate it.
And any other points that you wanna discuss with anybody listening regarding habitat or regarding just things that you have learned through different habitat techniques?
Sure. So, you know, one of the biggest things, and I think a lot of your listeners know this, whether or not they have a formal plan in place, is just the importance of having a plan. When you get your ideas down on paper, you get someone else to confirm those. And, you know, I think that sets you in a direction that you're comfortable with, and mm-hmm. You may adjust, but you're not going to veer off track, and so you have a more defined finish line. I think that is super important.
Yeah. You can't hit your target if you don't know what your target is.
You don't. And I, you know, I was in that boat with, I think, a lot of people that, hey, I got a handle on this, and we've got a pretty good idea, but another set of eyes is always going to help you gain that confidence and that understanding. And
right.
I think you guys did a podcast a while back, and I a lot of times I just hear some of y'all's podcasts and I smile because I'm starting to get it more. But I think Adam talked about vision.
Yeah.
And when we were walking through my property, I kind of knew what I was hoping to accomplish, but I didn't have the vision of what I need to do to it now. Mm-hmm. To get it to what I want it to be later.
Yeah, that's good.
And I recognize that now, and I've got more confidence that I can go in and take a spot that I need to put in a bedding thicket, or I need to do edge feathering, or whatever. I feel like I have that information and the skills to understand what it needs to look like today to make it look like what I want it to later down the road.
Mm.
So that was one of my big takeaways from you guys is the vision of seeing it and understanding the process.
I love that. Very good.
You know, I did write down a couple of things. You know, it's different for non-resident landowners. I think you have to curb your expectations a little bit.
Sure.
Your time's limited on your farm. You know, you're probably not going to get to hunt every perfect day when you're there.
Right.
So keep that in mind. You know, when it's a bad day, you know, and you're 4 or 5 hours from home, you still want to hunt. So hunt, but make it, you know, make it an observation sit, make it a stand that's low impact. You know, enjoy your piece of property, but understand, you know, you don't want to mess it up just because you're there.
That's right.
You know, and I think another thing with being a non-resident is you got to have those realistic goals, and especially on your harvest, because you can't choose every day that's optimal. You know, you may have that mega giant on camera, but, you know, conditions aren't right when you get there. And so just curb your expectations sometimes. Make your expectations fit your farm and not what social media is telling you to do or shoot. You don't have fun. Make good memories. Have those relationships with your family. You know, we'll probably forget the deer, but we won't forget the time spent there with family. So
there's no doubt about that. Absolutely. Absolutely. Man, I appreciate you sharing your time with us and coming on to discuss kind of this one, the success story of harvesting that buck with the bow, but then also what you've learned along the way, because you've got a cool story with the background that you have of natural resource management, but then owning a property, getting started, getting a plan, executing, and now killing a big deer. So that's super fun to hear about that kind of that full story, and hopefully it's going to resonate with someone else. So Patrick, we certainly appreciate it, and next season, maybe this time frame, we'll have another story to tell.
Man, that would be awesome. Maybe we can get back on here. I'll be happy to say every year I'll be happy to do it if we're not successful. It's fun. It's a fun journey.
Totally.
It's a lot of work, but a lot of reward as well.
Absolutely.
I appreciate you guys having me on.
Totally. All righty, guys. There you have it. It's not always that simple, but there's a lot to be said about having a firm plan, having a clear direction, and executing on anything in life, but specifically on habitat. That combination is deadly, and it works. And we're going to have more guys coming on and sharing same stories throughout the entire fall, because that is exactly what happens when good quality habitat work is put into place. And the stories never get old. They get better and better. So hope you guys are ready for them to listen to more success stories. So guys, thank you for listening. Thank you for being a part of the podcast. A lot of fun, exciting things coming in the weeks and months to come for Land and Legacy. So be paying attention, be ready. And also, be sure to check out the YouTube page. There are many, many videos that you guys are going to see dropping here. So some recent hunts, bow hunts, buck kills, and they're great. They're coming together really well. So excited to share those with you guys. Be sure to check them out on YouTube. Send us a message through social media handles, or send us an email at info@landandlegacy.tv. Thanks, guys, for listening. We'll catch you here next week.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.